Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In his new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, historian Ed Baptist reveals our dirty secret, slavery, the source of our national shame, was also the main source of our national wealth and the catalyst for America's rise as a global economic power. While such a truth is inherently an uncomfortable one, Baptist forces us to face the reality of the treatment of slaves in this country. He writes, understanding something of what it felt like to suffer and what it cost to endure the suffering is crucial to understanding the course of U.S. history. It is a great pleasure to welcome Edward Baptist to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. At what point did you start thinking about this and wanting to flesh it out?
Well, I think as I described to some extent in the introduction, the idea came to me when I was reading some of the WPA narratives, which are interviews that were conducted with formerly enslaved people in the 1930s by employees of the New Deal. And some of these are very short, but some of them are very, very long and discursive and show that the people who are interviewed are not only people who thought a lot about their experiences in slavery, but also people who are bringing to you the thoughts of a lot of other people as well, people that they talked to while they were still enslaved, for instance. So I felt like those were stories that needed to be told, and those were stories that needed to come out.
So much has come out about slavery, and yet it seems in reading the book, you realize how little we actually know in some cases. And I'm curious as to how that came to be, and ultimately, is our memory of it not wanting to remember it?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And I think you could say one of the turning points came about 30 or 40 years after the Civil War. And a lot of great historians have written about the process by which white Northerners and white Southerners essentially decide to agree to not talk about the role of slavery in causing the Civil War or the role of slavery in building the United States, and instead essentially try to sweep what was known as the race problem or the Negro problem under the rug and move forward as if slavery had not been so essential to the American economy or so central to the causing of the Civil War.
The numbers that you present in the book are staggering. You write that in 1783, at the end of the American Revolution, there were less than 800,000 slaves in the U.S. That number was shrinking. And then by 1861, there were 4 million slaves occupying 925,000 acres. Give us an idea of what happened over that period of time, a generation.
Yeah, one piece of that story is the expansion in numbers, the numbers of people enslaved that you talked about. And some of that comes from additional imports through the Middle Passage from Africa, although that's closed off in 1808. But what also happens is that the people who are enslaved and the children that they have who are also slaves are geographically moved, and they're moved west and they're moved south to areas that will actually grow cotton rather than tobacco or wheat or something like that. And this is very important because cotton is just in the process of becoming the single commodity that the growing industrial economy of Britain and then of the northern United States needs the most. Cotton is effectively the oil of the early industrial revolution, the first half of the 1800s. And enslaved people are pushed to supply this at faster and faster rates over time. And they do so.
It is fascinating in the book that you write average life expectancy for African Americans in the population went down when cotton prices went up. Life expectancy went back up when the prices dropped.
Yeah, one of the narrators somebody who was enslaved was transported by a slave trader in chains from Maryland down to South Carolina and then was able to escape, a guy named Charles Ball. He says, after he escapes, he says essentially that when cotton prices are high on a cotton plantation, the slaves, quote, must be prepared to make an acquaintance with hunger. And this is because slave owners would push the slaves to work more and more of the land in cotton and more of the agricultural year simply in cotton. And it was theoretically possible for enslaved people to grow cotton and corn, but as the cotton price went up, it was less likely that they'd be allowed to grow an equal amount of both.
Discuss a little bit about this, about the subtitle of this Making of American Capitalism. Of course, this was, I guess, always part of it, but when did it really start to become a driving force?
Well, I think for the United States, it's a crucial part of the economy from the very beginning, but it was certainly possible in the 1780s as American political leaders gathered to write the Constitution that slavery could have continued to decline in importance, which it had been doing, I think, since the Revolution. Certainly that was the case in the Chesapeake states, where a lot of people were being freed. But instead, they, in part at the urging of the delegates from the Deep South, write in the possibility that slavery can continue to expand. And that happens right at this moment where the global economy is changing and slave owners are discovering that they can produce this crop of cotton at increasingly faster rates. So that's one big part of the story. People make specific choices, political choices, that allow economic possibilities to emerge and grow. But the other part of it, I think, is that the world economy invests in expanding American slavery. So not just the South, but also the North and Britain and Europe. And the amount of credit that flows into the South to help lubricate the cotton economy and the buying and selling of slaves, the moving of people like Charles Ball by slave traders west to be sold, and they're very expensive, that is usually done on credit. And the credit usually comes in that time period from 1790 to 1860 from outside the South.
In one of just many troubling statistics in the book, you write that cotton picking rates increased about 400% from 1800 to 1860. The reason for that increase being?
Well, there's some debate. It's pretty clear that the seeds that were used in 1790 for cotton are different from the ones in 1860, and that probably makes the picking rate, it makes it possible for it to increase. But just because it's possible for it to increase doesn't mean that enslaved people are going to want to work like robots almost in the field all day long. Slave owners went to a great deal of trouble to drive people to pick as fast as they possibly could, and then they would record the number of pounds an individual picked, and then the next day they would expect them to pick at least that much, and so on and so on. And eventually they would raise that. Probably the most gripping illustration of this actually comes in the film of 12 Years a Slave, and it's directly taken from the account of Solomon Northup, who, of course, was a real person. And the slave owner is measuring the output of the different slaves, and different people have different outputs, but he pushes them all. He pushes them all to pick faster.
And it is through whipping that ultimately increases the rate.
Right. Right.
It forces greater speed.
Yeah, that's right.
At what point does that, as the subtitle indicates, this Making of American Capitalism. So this is driving the economy. So there is pressure. Who ultimately is making the money, and how does it become a focal point of our economy?
Well, I think a lot of people are making money. I mean, we could first say who's not making money, and that's enslaved people.
Of course,
that's
right.
Pretty obvious, but we have to remember that point. But a lot of the money is certainly going out outside the South. It's going to Northern and British cotton manufacturers. It's going to the people who then sell the cotton. Some of it is, or sell the cotton textiles to consumers. Some of the benefit goes to consumers who can now have access to a much greater variety of cloth and of clothing than they had before. Some of it goes to the bankers who lend the money. But that being said, a lot of it does stay in the South. If you look at the average wealth per white person in the United States, state by state, in 1860, I believe five of the top six states are in the South, and they're all cotton states, like Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi.
And you can add Georgia and Florida and South Carolina to that. And the fact that there is so much money there, and this is a very rich group of human beings, when did that start to alter?
Well, it doesn't really change until they're defeated in the Civil War. But certainly their relative power in the global economy changes after the panics of 1837 and 39, which have a lot in common with our recent financial unpleasantness here in the United States. There are a lot of parallels. But that enables some Northerners to realize that partly because of their interaction with the cotton economy and partly because of their own local decisions and acts, their economy in the North has started to become a bit more diversified and is no longer so directly dependent on shipping exports from the South to Great Britain.
So to look at that question that is so often asked of how much was a slave worth, what economic data do we have on that?
We have very strong data on how much an enslaved person cost in the dollars of any particular year, whether 1830 or 40 or 50 or what have you. What's complicated is comparing that to today's data or today's dollar. We understand what the cumulative inflation rate has been over time, but some economists would argue that that's not enough. If we just look at inflation rate, a 18-year-old enslaved man who would have sold for about $1,000 in New Orleans in, let's say, 1850 or 51, that works out to about $45,000 inflation adjusted in 2014. But some economists say what we should actually compare that to is the amount of labor that could buy in 1851 and what it could, and compare that to what the same amount of labor would cost in 2014. And that figure works out to something like $225,000. I can't tell you which figure is better or which is more accurate. They're both pretty big numbers.
So when it comes to the narratives of slavery and the stories that you tell in the book, what do you hope we get out of that and how it ultimately changes the history that we learn and in moving forward?
Well, I think my first goal is to tell a story about American history that I believe is true and is hopefully truer and more accurate than the stories that have come before. And whether that's the case or not, and certainly that implies that I'm building on the stories that came before, which is also true. I'm building on the work of lots of other historians and lots of archivists and enslaved people themselves who kept alive and told the stories of their own lives. But what people do with that after that point, I think, is really up to them. I mean, I certainly hope that it will lead to, in some small way, to greater justice in this country, to a greater sense of how much we all owe to enslaved people and to the work that they did to create this country and work that came at great cost to themselves. And also, I hope that we think about it as we look at what happened after emancipation, where we see that despite emancipation and despite the formal equality that to some extent was the case in the U.S. after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, to some extent some of the same kinds of injustices or parallel kinds of injustice continued to be inflicted on the descendants of enslaved people. And that certainly shapes the world that we live in today, and in the United States that we live in today.
The name of the book is The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. The book is published by Basic Books. Edward Baptist, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. I do appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Half Has Never Been Told. It's published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.